Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
We have two guests today. We thought we were going to have one. We thought we were going to have an AP who wants to go by the name of Bank, but he brought along a bodyguard. We're calling Teller, and he has some stories too. So we're welcome Bank and welcome Teller.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Why did you choose the name Bank?
Originally, I was gambling more recreationally. My background is an engineer, and the tribe had hired me to do construction management, build a brand new casino in California, and they actually hired me and brought me on to be the house banker, because in California, 25, 30 years ago, there was all player bank games, and if nobody wanted to bank, somebody had to bank, and they were too afraid to bank it themselves because it's in the gray area. And I said, yeah, I have money, I would bank it. And so I started out from day one in that casino being the actual house bank. So 24/7, 365, my money was in play. Nobody ever would buy the bank.
Yeah, so that the evolution of this, the Indian casinos themselves were not allowed to bank the game. So now there are corporations who have taken over this function. But at that time, there were no corporations. So and then as it started to evolve, we actually had a casino that paid us to bank. So that we would go down there and provide action 24 hours a day if somebody wanted to play. And then eventually the casino realized, wow, these guys are making a ton of money. We don't need to pay them. In fact, they would pay us to go if need be to go to bank.
Well, I wasn't getting paid. I was tipping liberally and trying to keep everybody happy.
But it was a lucrative job.
Yes, it was an excellent job. It was one of those things where you're always worried about who's going to steal from you, because I had to sleep some hours of some days.
What a wuss.
Exactly. But, you know, sometimes in the early morning, there's not much action, so you could go home and get some sleep.
Yeah, but it was the Wild Wild West. People were, I mean, there was so much cheating and all kinds of skullduggery going on. You know, now that's all moved over to the card rooms, not the Indian casinos, but it's still going on there.
So what kind of cheating would they try to do when you were the bank?
Well, a lot of the capping of bets, a lot of, you know, one of the simplest moves, which is probably just an advantage play, is after you bust, put your next bet out in the square, even though you don't have cards. These young dealers, they would bust their hand, they would just grab a stack, start paying everybody, and they would pay bets in squares that didn't have any cards related to them.
I've been paid numerous times on that, even in regular casinos.
There were a lot of marked cards. There were the most dangerous thing was when the dealer would get into cahoots with an agent to rip off the banker. And there were just, I mean, you couldn't count the number of scams that was going on.
Yeah, we had one obvious one like that where the dealer had actually invited somebody to join him to be his agent, and that person was obviously not a friend, and so that person turned him in immediately, and he actually was charged with trickery was all.
And trickery, is that an offense at that Indian casino?
Well, in that town, in that county, yes, trickery was the charge, and it was a $200 fine.
Yeah, I know some friends were ripped off on a pike out poker scam where they had the dice cup where you shake the dice, had a tiny camera built into the inside of the dice cup so that they could read what the dice read before they were revealed so they would know which hands to bet on, etc.
I may have played with those guys later on. I know a team that had a camera under the cup.
Yeah.
Asians.
All right. Now, Teller, you were a dealer back then at this casino?
Yeah, I was actually working as a bank teller, hence the nickname, and also kind of coordinating with the bank here. And I was going to community college, working as a teller, had friends that were working in the card room there. The way the dealing was set up, they had two blackjack tables and two poker tables, and so if you were hired to be a dealer, you basically had to deal six deck shoe, which was a 1 to 200 game by the time I came, and then they had a single deck blackjack, which is a 5 to 200 handout game, and then you had to deal Texas Hold'em. So I started working there when I was 19, and yeah, I guess that's the short version.
So can you tell us some of the scams you used to rip off Bank when he was the...
I actually kind of came in after he was... By the time I came in, he was no. It was still, they converted to like a player's pool bank, is what they called it. So the casino was kind of managing the funds that were owned by the players. Someone like Bank would have started that player's pool and front the money to kind of get that going. And at some point, the casino transitioned into managing that fund. So they were.
And most casinos, 100% of that fund didn't go back to the players.
I can confirm some of that just from my time working there, but they were charging a commission to play the hand, which is the way they were generating revenue, which was I think 25 cents from $1 to $10 bet, up to 25 was 50 cents, $1 to go up to 100, and if you bet over 100, it was $2 a hand. So my involvement as far
and players
as
players are playing this,
yeah.
And making up for it by playing badly.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Do they have a joker in the deck or anything to go in the player's favor?
No, but they would do these promotional things to try to get money back to the players. So if you got 3 sevens, it'd be $50. Or if you got like a suited blackjack, it was $25. And that money was filtering back from the players' pool. They did promotional blackjack tournaments to try to help keep that fund because they had it posted on the wall. And people knew it was always around $50,000 to $60,000. It would have started to creep up. They'd do a big monthly tournament or something and filter money back.
Table Mountain outside Fresno, their deal was they would have 2-to-1 blackjack. I think it was on Mondays or something like that.
Yeah, ours was Sunday night, which kind of leads into when I wasn't working Sunday nights, Bank and I, originally it was him and a couple of other folks, but they were playing pretty hard, and I kind of got involved with that for a while until we finally got asked not to play any longer. And I was an employee, which kind of made it a little bit sketchier than some of the folks.
So you're just flat betting the table max on the 2-to-1 blackjack?
On 2-to-1 blackjack, the one I remember well was at Cache Creek. And at that time, there weren't a lot of APs in Northern California. But I went for the promotion, and they had a $500 table limit. And I was loaded to go play 500 a hand. I was hoping to play multiple hands. But the morning I got there, I met a whole network of APs that existed either in the Bay Area or the Sacramento area who I'd never run into before. But you got one spot, and it didn't last a long time.
Yeah, see, I would go up to Table Mountain every week, and that was the place
from
where...
From Vegas.
No, from California. I was living in California at the time. But... That was the place where I lost $20,000 flat betting $100 a hand with 2-to-1 blackjack.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's hard to do.
That's a horrendous loss. I mean, I was playing three hands of 100, but still, that's a horrendous loss at $100 a hand.
You think they should have put back those two aces from the deck that they took out?
Yeah, maybe.
Cut back on the fives or something.
Yeah.
It's the Spanish 21 concept, right?
I have to tell one story about this player's pool is also going on currently in Oklahoma, right? Where the house is not allowed to bank those games. So they have a player's pool, and the money that accumulates is supposed to go back to the players in some form of promotion. So I was playing at the Hard Rock in Catoosa, and this is many years ago, and I asked the dealer, because they were charging commission, and I said, because a lot of those casinos, what they'll do is they'll say, on these days of the week, there's no commission. That's the way they give the money back to the players. So at this particular casino, I said, so when are the promotions? And the dealer just shook his head, and he said, never. And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, I've complained to the gaming commission twice. They never have any promotions to give the money back to the players.
If anybody's interested, I would take the job as the first counter on the players' pool. I think the person who counts it first has the advantage in this.
Yeah.
All right. So at one time, Bank, you solved a slot machine. How did you go about that? And how long did you get away with it? And was it successful?
Yeah, it was... A period in the 90s, company out of Reno, IGT, everybody knows of them.
I've heard of them.
First iteration was skill-based gaming. And the distinguishing feature was they were video reels, three reels, and they had a stop button at the bottom of each reel. And this was supposed to be class two skill-based gaming. And you could either pay so much a spin, like 25 cents a spin to play the game, or you could pay by the minute to play this game. And if you loaded it up, it was $5 a spin when you're max betting it. But you could stop the individual reels. Well, a guy we call Charlie, he had spent some time and he could stop those reels. Well, the casino, as part of a promotion, had a free play game. Come out, learn how it works, and see how to play it. Well, I went down there because somebody alerted me to it, a BP that we know. And so I went down there and I hit the $1,000 jackpot within a couple minutes. But then once that was done, the game had some sort of governor on it, some sort of guarantee to get back to the return that was promised to the casino. And now you could not stop it on that jackpot no matter what you did. And so my solution, why they give me credit for solving it, is I looked at the series of symbols and I said, well, if I move these golden apples up to the top line, when I go for this third reel and it forces it one past or one short, both are I have a paying line on another line. And so now I get either pay $10 or $12. It's costing me $5 to spin it every time, and I'm paying $1 a minute to play the game, but I could spin it 6 to 10 times a minute and 100% successful on getting the $10 or the $12 pay. And so my dad had taught me, you know, shear the sheep every year, rip the hide off once. So I was trying to gauge how much they could take. I was pretty well known as the only advantage player in the area. They see me playing some stupid game, some slot machine. And the general manager actually laughed at me, and he knew all kinds of people had gone broke with a system on playing slot machines. But
well, if you watch a guy collect, now did you, in front of him when he was watching, did you still collect 20 times in a row?
I played. He never really stopped. He just laughed and insulted me on the walk by. I was printing the tickets out at about $300. This wasn't ticket in, ticket out. This was the old paper, just print out. And so I was sending them to the cage with whoever I could find, $300 at a time. And
was the money coming back $300 at a time?
That's a good question, right?
I pretty much tipped whoever would run the money, but it was always a small amount. But there were always volunteers. And like everything I've ever done that was successful, people just gather around and look to see what you're doing, and they want to try to emulate that. And
that's a bad thing to have happen in that situation.
Well, and I think Bob has mentioned it before, that if you're well known in an area, you can't play for very long without drawing attention.
Yes.
And so that whole thing lasted 5 days. And about the third day, the casino realized that they had a problem. I was getting them for in excess of $20,000 a day. And IGT said, no, the game isn't susceptible. It's not vulnerable. And so IGT said they would back the machine, and if there was any loss, they would pay it. And the casino was no longer on the hook. So on day four, I thought that meant 24/7. I no longer had a concern about anybody from the casino stopping me. But then one of the shift managers I was friends with said, IGT is on their way. They're coming from Reno.
To watch you.
Yes. And so at that point, I knew it was going to be over. I played as hard as I could. Actually went to the bathroom. I came back from the bathroom and the machines were dark. But BP had actually made a few phone calls, and IGT had revealed where these machines were at other California casinos. And in Chicken Ranch, in Sonora, they had these machines. And so we jumped in the car, drove 10 hours. And as I was coming across the parking lot, security guard met me and shook my hand, used my real name, and said he'd been waiting for me. And they had the worst picture of me from surveillance. This is in the black and white days. They didn't have email accounts. It's a screen capture, not a flat screen monitor. And they faxed it down there, but it still looked enough like me that they were ready for me. This guy was nice. He took me inside, showed me the machines were dark, and those machines never made it back onto the market again.
Go figure. All right.
Reminds me of the story of Frank B. in this episode about where they let him spin the big six wheel. And, you know, within minutes, he was able to start hitting the 40-1 on the big six wheel. Yeah. I love this when they get this idea to let the players get more involved in the outcome of the game.
I was in a promotion like that, and they had a big wheel, and you could spin it. and the guy I was just talking about that we call BP, he actually perfected the spin. So even when I was drawn to spin, I could con them into letting BP take my spin for me.
Now,
those were only $1,000 spins, though.
It's okay. I was able to use that in one promotion where there was a $5,000 if you hit the right number. And the rule was you had to, it had to go around at least once. And if it went short, you just could
do
spin
over
again. So I kind of walked it up until I got the right thing and hit it. And they the crowd is booing. I mean, this is not what they came to see. They didn't want to see this. But I finally hit it. And they said, we got check surveillance. See you. And they paid me. But they instituted a Bob Dancer rule shortly thereafter. So
I find that with the casinos, a lot of times they have these promotions. But shortly after we get started, the rules start changing.
Oh, yeah. Did you go to the promotion at Morongo on the Friday the 13th? Were you there for that?
I was not in on that.
Okay. So I...
I was.
Oh, you were there? I didn't. We didn't know each other really at that time. But, I mean, everybody in the world seemed to be there.
All right. So back at that time, you were barred at a casino back like 25 years ago. Now, are you able to get back in there now?
No, I actually talked to the general manager. It had been 25 years, and everybody who was barred in the same incident that I was involved in, basically they barred everybody that was on that table. We really had nothing to do with it. It was a dealer who was pulling the card out of the shoe too far, so I could see the next card coming, which makes blackjack infinitely easier.
Was this teller?
No.
Not this time.
So they kicked everybody out, but not you. But then they didn't let you back in.
Yeah, basically they sent us all letters. So we got the registered letter. And I said, not at this address, no interest in a registered letter. I had, when the gig was up, it was bad. One of the people at the table had been dealt two aces face up. I signaled next card off is going to be a nine. And instead of splitting his aces, he just takes a hit. Well,
At least he didn't double down.
No,
I played the rest of that hand out, but I was stuffing chips in my pockets as I was playing. And at the end of that hand, I briskly walked to the car, got in the car, and drove away. And everybody knew that was a signal we had to go. So nobody actually got detained right there, but they all got the letter. They all signed for it. I didn't. But so we were all barred. The dealer was fired. And, you know, years went by and everybody got back in. And so I would ask, hey, can I come back in? Change management 3 or 4 times, lots of expansions. It's much bigger now, nice hotel, restaurant, everything. I can't even go in to take a look. And the general manager knows me on a first name basis. And he has a personal axe to grind over an advantage play that happened many years before where I was dealing single deck blackjack to him. And his wife was actually working with me to get him blackjacks, and I was dealing for tips. And he played that way for 4 months, never knew that the deck was stacked, never knew those blackjacks were something I was fabricating for him. And so the guy was an idiot. He's a total degenerate gambler, and now he's the general manager of a casino.
Who wouldn't you want running a casino, right?
And so...
So the next card game, the dealer that was exposing the card, was this intentional? He was cheating? Or was this just like you found a sloppy dealer?
I thought I'd found a sloppy dealer, but he was getting tips. He was trying to maximize his tips. And as soon as we started tipping more, you know, now I'm betting table max and footing a quarter out for him, those cards were coming out a lot further. And I wasn't just getting an occasional peek that I could or maybe not see. Now it was totally obvious. So whether it was incidental to start with or it was always just his wish that somebody would pick up on it, either way, I didn't have anything to do with the dealer. I didn't know him before. I'd never talked to him since. But I do know he was fired.
Even degenerate.
Yeah, we have another mutual acquaintance that was involved in that, I think, as well. And that person's kind of gone a different route. He's actually an engineer. But Is that correct?
Yeah, he was at the table. He was playing in the middle. I was at the backside on third base with the largest bets, but he was in the middle and would often stand short and things to feed the cards I needed to me because it was a face-up shoe game. And so, yeah, he was involved in that, and he got the disbarment letter and everything.
So, but you guys, had you worked out signals beforehand?
No.
So you just worked them out on the fly, and this guy in the middle of the table was helping you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I was signaling basically the value of the cards with basically just a finger signal. I would move whichever finger forward for the value of the cards, and I just numbered them across my hands from 1 to 10.
So the middle finger is an 8. So if you said, if you this is an 8 signal I'm giving you, I thought it meant I was 1 year old.
Well, that could be a 3, right?
Yeah, it's either a 1 or a 3.
Which hand was that? Yeah. Is that your left or your right?
And so that was a real crude signaling system on the fly without stepping away from the table, you know, and...
Everybody did well with it.
Oh, yeah. Everybody made a lot of money. I still have the chips. As a matter of fact, from that story, I never cashed those chips. I still have them. I even offered to give them back if they would let me back in.
Why would you not cash them?
The heat was pretty heavy, and I didn't know anybody who could take that amount of chips into that small casino. You know, we could have fed them back to them maybe 100 at a time. And, you know, it was a significant hit. It wasn't five figures, but it was a high four-figure hit.
So, but you never cashed them, so they didn't lose to you.
I tried to give them that logic.
Uh-huh.
But the chips have changed since then, and so now they're just collector's items.
Uh-huh. So, but you were, since you were messing around with his wife at the table, that he's not forgiving for that.
No, he seems to, well... Yeah, it seems to be personal. I mean, she was a nice enough lady, large-chested, very friendly, just seemed like somebody I should help out if ever there was somebody to help out.
To tie back into one of the earlier points that the bank made and the person that was in the middle of that table assisting, that was a time when I was, you know, pretty young, and we all, in a way, the people that were aware of what the bank was doing looked up to that and found some admiration in the ability to beat these kind of games. So the fact that that person was ended up being a party to that is not really a surprise. A lot of us, if we had been there, I'm sure would have kind of fallen right in, even though we were very raw and not skilled. But it was fun to kind of be a part of that, a little bit of the danger. A lot of us were very young. It's exciting. And he was, a little bit older than our kind of core group of people that are still friends to this day.
I remember doing incredibly stupid things, and actually, I remember dealers really doing incredibly stupid things like what you're describing. And I remember one dealer in particular who would look back then. The dealers checked their hole cards, and I had a dealer who would literally look at his hole card, say insurance, and shake his head no, or shake his head yes. And I remember thinking at the time, like, are you insane? You could just get fired immediately for this. But I was the stupid one for not getting up and walking away from the table. I mean, when this guy is just sort of revealing his hole card to me intentionally.
Yeah, that was about, you know, to elaborate a little bit on the extent of my involvement when I was 19, 20 dealing. That was about the kind of things that we would do for players. That was a pretty active thing. And it was a situation where the bank was not it was not a house bank game, as we talked about earlier. So some of our exposure to being was basically a reprimand. It was about all you could get. But we would frequently tell people that were taking care of us as dealers with Tokes, obviously, give them information. That was a common thing that we would do.
And in a six deck game, or even a single deck game, for me, a lot of times I wanted to see what the burn card was, and so they would all show me the burn card. They would all flash me the burn card. You know, that was fairly common. And they would deal to the last card.
Yeah,
shuffle up the stub if they had to.
Yeah, many times, because I was at least skilled enough to participate on a level on the Sunday night action when we had the 2-1 blackjacks. When I was earlier on, when I was working that shift, we often I dealt the single deck game. It would run if the count was in the player's favor and we were getting compensated, we would always run it out to the last, shuffle the stud back up to finish the hand. That was a regular occurrence. And then when I was later on when my shift had changed, that's when I kind of participated on the player side of that. And we had a pretty good run, but it was starting to become a thing where too many people were doing what the bank was doing. And because this area was a smaller area, you know, things like that don't last forever. And then we finally got asked not to play anymore.
So was your introduction into Advantage Play banking, or had you learned to count cards prior to that? Or how did you first get into this?
I was an underage gambler. And so I had gone into every place I could gamble before I was legal to do it. Have a great back half story from 16 years old. I was in Lake Tahoe playing a slot machine with my aunt. And I've been playing for a while. And the one thing I remember about those days is how black your hands got from the coins. And
especially if you use nickels.
Yeah,
nickels were dirtier than quarters for some reason.
So first time the cocktail waitress went by, I just ordered a rum and Coke. I didn't know anything about ordering drinks at 16. But I had a rum and Coke. And next time the cocktail waitress came by, I said rum and Coke again. And she asked for my ID. And I jumped right up and whipped my wallet out and got my license out and put it in front of her. And oftentimes, that's enough. Because to me, bluffing's free. And so many times they don't know where to look, they don't know how to do the math, whatever, and they thank you very much. So she says, sorry, sir, I can't serve you. And I said, well, just bring me a Coke then. She said, sorry, sir, I can't serve you. And so my aunt, who was next to me, said, well, bring me a Coke. She said, that works. And she walked off, and I went right back to playing the machine. 16 years old, Lake Tahoe.
Nevada was a different place back then.
Uh-huh.
And so I had been gambling and kind of working a lot of angles. I really didn't have access to the library that I needed, because we go back to 1981, 82, 83 in those days. It wasn't widespread and the network wasn't that good. A guy gave me a basic strategy card for blackjack. I just happened to be playing with him. He got one out of his wallet and handed it to me. You know, and then I was starting to develop my own count system. I basically was counting aces and tens and guessing at the composition of the remainder of the deck. And so I didn't have a real good handle on guessing the stub and the thickness of it, but I was making strategy adjustments and sending the money based on what was left. If they dealt me two rounds and I hadn't seen an ace, here comes the money. It's going. And so I had a very crude systems already in place. Reno, Nevada, 18 years old, went saw Hello Hollywood Hello. That gives away the casino. It's MGM Reno. And I played 4 hours of blackjack. I won only about $400 on a $100 buy-in. Gave the chips to my girlfriend, who was 21. Sent her to the cage, said, I'll meet you at the car. They didn't cash those chips. They stopped her. They took the chips. They followed her out to the car. I rolled down the window. I wouldn't open the car. I wouldn't let them into the car. I told them I didn't have any ID. We got to leave, but we never got paid. They stole our money. So I think in those days, you could play as long as you lost.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
And so I kind of learned from that even if I was good enough to beat the blackjack, I better wait till I'm old enough to beat the blackjack. And so then I went some in college. I became the coupon guy. So I was going to school at Sacramento, Sac State, and you could jump the bus to Reno, and you got your fun book when you got there. And so I began hustling those fun books, and the lady that passed them out, she liked money too. So I would get 10, 12 fun books, and I would be trying to pass these match plays off around the casino in my 4 hours before they brought me back.
Now, had you learned, you had basic strategy already?
Yes, I had basic strategy down, yes.
Did you eventually buy a book?
I ran into a guy. I was playing a jacks or better machine, and I had held an ace-10 suited on a 9-6 jacks or better, and a guy next to me said, no! And I looked at him, and he actually got in his wallet, got his strategy card out, and I asked him, where do you get this? And he said, in Reno, Nevada, there's a gambler's bookstore. So away I went. And I invested a substantial amount of my bank.
The heavens opened when you walked into
books,
that store.
Yes, and books, software, everything. And so now, all of a sudden, I had enough information to be dangerous. I knew, they should start you with risk of ruin and bankroll and all those other things. But those things come later. So, yeah, I was banking. And by the time I was banking in my late 20s, I had access to the library. I could count. I have always just done a high-low, and I side count aces and fives. And so I play a little bit different than the high-low players, and I've played at tables with guys in different places where after we left, they're like, what the hell were you doing? And I said, well, I have some side counts I use too, and I make strategy adjustments based on that. So it was different because I wasn't playing exactly the way other people thought I should play, but the games were so good in California early on that I lost once playing single deck. I took a $3,000 loss at that 5 to 200, but every other time I made $1,000 or more every time I played.
That does not mirror my experience with playing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the edge at card counting is so low, you must have just gotten very lucky to only have one losing session. Even with a massive spread, I mean, the edge just isn't that big.
I actually have to tell one little quick story. There was a young man who found me playing, and he became Ernesto, King of the Minus World. So when I would walk off and leave the single deck game, he would stay there and grind through all those minus counts. And this guy had unbelievable luck. Minus five, minus six, not a problem for that guy. He could flat bet that $5 a hand and grind through it, and I could come back. And so I often didn't play the negative counts. I was able to walk away. I wouldn't even give him $5. And then I would go to three hands of 200. And I was getting about three dealer mispays an hour.
Well, that helps.
That's strong.
Yes.
And so at, you know, a $200 loser that's paid as a $200 winner is a $400 swing. And anytime I hit to 22, I always give it the yes and tucked it. Especially if it was a five card 22. And so those were frequently paid.
Yep. No, I've had that experience as well. And, you know, if I had a three or four card 16, I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. Now I'm losing my train of thought.
While we do the commercials, Richard, why don't you think about that and we'll get back to you. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In November, they're effectively double points all month in terms of Walmart gift cards. Earn and redeem $25 worth of points, namely $8,334 because it's a 0.3 club, and exchange them for a $50 gift card. Limit 10 cards per person. On Thanksgiving Day is a $32,000 hot seat promotion. Every 3 minutes between 8 a.m. and midnight, one lucky player with a card inserted will receive $100 in free play. Auto Slash. Since Richard is so tired of me doing all the commercials, he wants to become the Auto Slash commercial specialist. So, Richard, show us what you got.
Okay. Six things you should know about AutoSlash.com. Number one, Bob and I have been using it for years, and we used it long before they were ever a sponsor. Number two, it's free. Don't need to say any more about that. Number three, the average user saves about 30%. Over other car rental companies' websites. Number four, any discount or coupon that is out there, they will find it because when you go there, there are little check boxes and you can say, I have a Costco card or I have a United Airlines frequent flyer card. So any of those coupons or discounts that are out there, they'll find them. Number five, they have a pay for it now option. I recently rented a car when I put my info in for this. The option, if I paid for it at the time that I made the reservation, was 17%. And if you take this option, you still can cancel that reservation as long as it's more than 48 hours in advance of the rental. And number six, the most important thing, the best thing about AutoSlash is they have a tracker. So whether you make your reservation at AutoSlash or at any other car rental company, you go back to them and you put your reservation in the tracker. And any time between then and the time of the rental, if they find a cheaper price, you get an email that says, hey, we found it cheaper. And you just click on it and you go and you make the cheaper reservation. So, it's a no-lose thing because, as I said, it's free. And for our listeners, it really helped us, by the way, when some of you did reach out on social media and mention that you heard about Auto Slash on Gambling with an Edge. So if you go rent a car and you have a good experience, or if you have a bad experience, mention it, mention you heard it on our show. And that is autoslash.com. Check it out.
And number seven, I don't want to be searching all of these websites. I like the idea of just signing up and knowing that I'm getting really the best or close to the best every time without a lot of hassle on my part. I'll hassle nickels and quarters on the video poker machines, but on the auto rental, I would just rather somebody else did it. Auto Slash does a good job at that.
I would just say you don't actually have to sign up. You don't sign up for them. I mean, you do your reservation, but they don't have any of your info. You don't have an account or anything. So,
all right, at videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Face Card Frenzy. You may play this game anywhere from 6 coins per line to 10 coins, with the odds improving as you increase your bet. In this game, full houses and quads, including jacks, queens, and kings and aces, return a lot more than usual. To make the math work, all pay schedule categories are bumped up, meaning that you need an entirely new strategy to play this game. In addition, no games in this variety released, returning more than 99%, so it would take one hell of a promotion to make this game worth playing. At the recent gambling show, I asked them why they were releasing games where the top pay schedule is over, under 99%, and they said they did that for a few years, because the casinos requested it, but then that has changed, and casinos said, well, at least give us some better options. We don't have to take them. But so now all the games that are released by videopoker.com include options that go up into the high 99%. All right, we are returning to Bank and Teller. That does sound like that'd make a good magic thing. Before we broke, Richard was mumbling to himself something about a 3 or 4 card 16. Do you remember what that was all about, Richard?
Yeah, what I was actually trying to say is if I had a 3 or 4 card 17, there are times when you know the dealer has specifically 18 and you have 17. And in a face-down game, that's a big edge to hit that hard 17. But if I had a 3 or 4 card.
Well, yeah, if you know he has 18.
Yes, specifically 18. Against a 20, it's not much of an edge. But against an 18, it is a big, it's worth hitting if you can get away with it. But when I would hit it, I would very coolly say, give me a 5. And if they gave me a 5, I would tuck the hand. And usually if you ask for a 5 and get the 5, they pay that 20 too. And if they don't, and they go, wait a minute, you had 17, now you have a very good excuse to say, oh, I added wrong, I thought I had 16. So
it's an oops, excuse me.
Yes.
Yeah, but you only can get away with that so many times with one dealer.
You'd be surprised.
All right. So, Bank, in your original email to us, you described yourself as a coupon maven. You gave us one example. Are there others? And do you still consider yourself a coupon maven?
Yeah, I still hustle coupons from time to time. The money's running down a little bit, but one example was they had first ace coupons in the daily nickel. So it's the little sheets you see for free out on the newsstands. And it wasn't me, but somebody I know went around and stole all the magazines and cut all the first ace coupons out. And I just paid for them. So we were negotiating. I ended up buying 300 of them, which is a lot of first ace coupons to use.
Wow. All at the same casino.
Yes.
I mean, that's a risk, right? That the casino's going to let you.
And so it turned out that they would only take $5 bets, which made them pretty useless. Except this is the same casino that had the $250 bonus for 3 blackjacks in a row. So anytime anybody in that casino had two blackjacks working, I was always somewhere to be found, and I always had an ace coupon, and they let them start the third hand with an ace with only a $5 bet to take the shot at the $250 bonus, which I always split with them, being the nice guy that I am.
And if they lost, you would not insist on being paid because you only collect on winners.
That's exactly. Exactly. And I have all of the magic coupons. And so, you know, I wouldn't get one down every day with 250 or 125 my share in play, but I would get several a week down that way.
And the casino was good with this because obviously it's a casino knew you were the coupon guy.
Oh, absolutely. They knew who it was. And it was the player's pool, and they weren't all that really concerned about where the player's money went.
Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, that. It's funny that some casinos really feel like an ownership interest in that player's pool, right? They don't want you winning it, even though it's not their money and it doesn't cost them anything. But some casinos do get it, and yeah, they don't care.
Yeah, I think part of bank strategy that I've picked up on when I was playing with him and we'd run around a little bit was trying to create a very fun environment. And you do that, and it kind of can be a little bit contagious for the other players and other patrons of that property. And when you're creating that environment, I think they see some residual, you know, potential there where people are happy, they're going to stay longer, they're going to game longer. And that was always something that I saw you do throughout, even when we're running around playing poker and other things. Just try to keep the mood lively, I guess.
Yes, I had another. We went on a cruise. Very small cruise to Ensenada. I think Carnival Cruise. People have taken that 4-day cruise. They had a $5 match play in the newsletter. They slide under the doors. And my father-in-law, or my wife's father-in-law, he was clothes hanging them from under the doors of other people's cabins until he figured out they were actually on the maid's cart. So he went and stole several hundred newsletters off the maid's cart and cut out all these $5 match plays. And I was like, we have exactly 4 days to run these things.
Yeah.
A very small casino. And I can make friends with anybody and I can convince anybody, but it's a $5 match play. Even when we're chopping it, you know, it doesn't have that much value. So yes, we hustled the coupons, but there were times that the coupons really didn't need to be hustled.
So you started out banking and then you were going to Reno. So you were a road warrior. And with most of us, what happens is at some point in our life, we meet a female. How did that go?
I had been playing a lot of poker. Hold'em was coming on strong. I hadn't worked a job in 8 years. So I'd been pretty much on the road for 8 years. And a friend of mine was having a party. And they called the poker room, asked me to come down. And the last line they used on me was, drunk, horny, single women with jobs. At that point,
Bob wants to go now.
Which of those adjectives was the most attractive?
Jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. It always comes back to the solid, steady income, I think.
And so I felt
there are times in my life where other adjectives were more important than jobs.
And I felt like my manhood was being called into question because this is the third time this herd of drunk women had called the poker room to see if I would come out to the club where they were at. And so I finally decided I'd go home and shower, shave, clean up, and head over that way. And so on my way into the club, as I'm walking up, this girl says, you must be the bank. And I said, yes, I am. And so she introduced herself and we went inside. And by the end of the night, we seemed to be getting along. And she moved away. She was a traveling nurse that was only there on a short-term assignment. She moved away. She'd been gone for a week or so. And I had her number and I called and said, hey, I'm going to come down and visit. And it's been 20 years and we're still visiting. It took about a year and we ended up getting married. But when I first came down, I was still playing. And I was playing poker. I was running to a couple of the Indian casinos, running promotions. And she worked 7 to 7, hardworking woman. I didn't make it home by 7 when she came home. She didn't like it. My stuff's on the front porch.
And wow.
So I'm like, my plan B is a pretty good plan B. I can work as an engineer. I can make $100,000 a year. Would you prefer that I get a job? And so I got a job, and I actually didn't play for one solid year. 365 days. I played on 366 day.
Now, wait a minute. Were you making more than $100,000 a year gambling prior to that?
Yes.
Now, and she didn't get that? She didn't?
I was walking in those days with, you know, 25, 30 just in my pocket, and I had money stashed all over. You know, I would often just hide money at people's houses just so nobody can put a gun to my head to get my money. And I probably wasn't a big fan of banks, and I later would learn safe deposit boxes aren't as bad as what people think.
Well, but so she didn't believe you, or you just didn't tell her that you were making more than that as a gambler?
I don't think she really cared how much I was making. She had a good job also. She's a nurse. It's not a secret. You know, and she would prefer a more steady lifestyle. And it just happened that we were going to a wedding in Reno. And while we were there, I got to play.
On the 366th day.
Yeah, I had been on banishment for 365 days. Day 366 was actually a poker session.
Oh, wait. So it wasn't enough just to get a job. You also had to stop gambling completely?
I had to sit out for one full year.
Wow, this must be some woman to have... I mean, because, I don't know, I ended up going through a lot of those kind of discussions and, you know, obviously never pursued those women anymore because...
Yeah, what... Even if she was drunk, horny, and had a job?
Single.
Yeah, single?
But, drunk, horny, single,
yes,
and had a job.
Sorry, that was a deal breaker for me. I mean, I say often, one of the reasons I married my wife was she got it that this professional gambling was a job. I mean, she just understood it. And
to defend my wife, and I have to at this point, because she'll listen to this podcast, is that she understands now. She understands very well now. And I hear her tell other people, he doesn't gamble. So she now realizes that if I don't have an edge of some sort, I'm not involved.
Right. Sure. And
so when I went back to gambling, one of my coworkers said, come play poker. I'll put up all the money. Zero risk to you. Just happened. My wife was teaching a class one night a week, 6 to 10 hours were good. So I just played for 15 weeks with a guy bankrolling me. I just take 25% of the wins. I didn't believe in makeup. So I'd just take 25% of the wins, and he'd fade all the losses on a session-by-session basis. And we made 12 grand in 15 weeks. And my wife decided that maybe I did have an edge.
I guess.
And I can corroborate to her being pretty special, because at that time, I was part of the group that was kind of following the bank around, maybe that next generation of aspiring AP folks. And when the bank just disappeared off the face of the planet, and we couldn't locate him anywhere. Anyway, then on a side note, I was also a groomsman.
He had a honey of a honey.
Yeah.
So, you asked not to be questioned too closely about your current place. When you came to Vegas, say 5 or 10 years ago, what would your days be like?
Well, really, I started kind of hitting Vegas in the 2000, maybe 2-3 range. And I came and I played double deck blackjack. I was very loud, lots of fun, but known to run clear to the craps table to high five people. You know, I played, you know.
Wait, what do you mean to high five people?
High five.
High five.
Oh, high five.
High five people. Okay. You know, and I played.
You can hide people under the table, Richard. Yeah. Haven't you seen that?
And I played, you know, black chips. I played, you know, $100 and went as high as like two hands of 800 at that point with my bankroll. And yeah, you know, one time I had like 940 out there and I got 2 8s against a 10. And I was like, this is exactly what I deserve, you know. And so I tell my friend, I said, this is a losing play, but I'm going to lose less if I go ahead and split these. And so I don't really make a hand on either side, but dealer busts and life is good. And so, yeah, I just had a couple $1,000 swing. And so I high-five my friend and people are looking and we're being loud. And I see people over at basically the craps table had stopped to watch to see how the hand was resolved. This was at the always famous Riviera.
Ah, wow. The Riviera is now kind of imploded. And you also said you used to stay at the Plaza. These, as casinos in Vegas go, these are the armpit of Vegas casinos. Why did you happen to pick them?
I basically was where they would... I was playing carded by then. Players cards actually came about early in my career. Players cards weren't a thing. But in that part of my career, players cards, comps, I was hustling comps. I'd read Max's book. You know, I tend to slow the blackjack game down. I'm loud. I don't mind playing with other players, take a lot of time, and I leave the table a lot, you know, for various reasons, usually strategic of my own, but, you know, those were the places that would reward my level of play without backing me off, so I could get free rooms anytime I picked up the phone. If I needed 12 rooms, I got 12 rooms. You know, the hosts understood, the hotel's empty, you know, don't tell me there's value in these soft comps. You know, if I want show tickets, give me show tickets. Whatever I want, give it to me. And I was pretty spoiled. I honestly was very spoiled. And I have at least two good stories about that. One, Kim's about in 2008 in Reno. It's Grand Sierra now. But I was playing double deck, playing big. And the host came by to check on me, which they do. And so I wanted to go to the Italian for dinner. Can't do it. I said, no, you can do it. You know, and I'm looking around. Nobody else playing as big as me in this joint. I want to go to the Italian for dinner. And he said, well, there's a private party. So eventually he comes back. We'll go to dinner. I got to go to dinner with you. We'll go together 7 o'clock. So I'm sitting over there on the side, little two top, eating with my host. And in walks the big party that's at the main table. And at that time it was Senator Barack Obama. He was the Democratic candidate for president. And he was actually, you know, there in town and was making a speech and campaign rally, and they had blocked the restaurant for him to come have dinner there. So oftentimes I would put the screws to the hosts an awful hard, and somehow they worked out with Secret Service so I could sit in there and have dinner.
All right. Now,
how did that end, by the way, at the Riviera? I mean, eventually you must have been barred, right?
No, I was never barred at the Riviera. I was backed off a few times.
Oh, that okay, backed off.
And usually if I backed off, I waited about 6 months. I still had the same host. I would call. This was a female host at the Riviera for a lot of years. Once left, went somewhere else. And she said, oh, yeah, I think you could come back. And then...
Her name wasn't Debbie, was it?
No, it was... Funny. Amy. And so she would let me play. And, of course, after I'd been backed off, I had a pretty good losing session on one of my return trips. And that seemed to, like, pave the way for quite a while again. And I didn't really hurt them. I no longer took any five-figure wins from them. Once I got 4, 5, 6 ahead, I would usually shut it down and just call it a day. Because I felt like the Riviera was such a dump by that point that they couldn't take a $10,000 loss in the pit and still let you come back.
You told us before we started that you have a story about Pechanga, which is in Temecula near San Diego.
Yeah.
What's that all about? Was Teller involved? He's nodding his head too.
Oh yeah, Teller was in on this one, and I think he was probably the impetus for it. Somehow he got vacation time or something, and he convinced me that we were going to road trip it. Go ahead, you could tell. You probably remember the specifics a lot more than I do.
Well, I could tell some of the early stuff for sure, but we had another person that used to spend seasonal time visiting his grandkids, I believe, where we are from, and we took a little road trip and drove down. I was probably about 20. Took a road trip, picked him up, and then made our way to Pechanga. I'm not sure how they pronounce that. But and that was when I was playing a lot of poker. And we went down and played the tag team tournament, which was a half Hold'em, half Omaha. Two people play on the same stack of chips. Bank played Omaha, which was not really my stronger game, but I was a pretty solid Hold'em player. And we actually won the tournament, which was probably the biggest poker score that I had made in a tournament at that point. But we were playing late at night every night and went to go stay with a kind of friend of a friend, lady that was a dealer at a place that we knew from a long time ago, and showed up really, really late, almost morning, probably closer to morning than evening, really. And we're just going to crash there, and I think we're heading to Viejas or something the next day or, you know, on that trip anyways. And they
have... Your house is almost 100 miles away. I mean, it's quite a distance.
Yeah.
We are already like 800 miles from home by the time we're at Pechanga. We've been on the road for many days. We put in a lot of miles.
Yeah. Bank is allergic to cats, which is part of the key to this whole thing. So he actually slept in the car, and I was on a couch. And then, well, you're going to have the first impact that happened, I guess, would be your story.
So here. I abandoned the cat-laden house because it's making me sick. So I go out, and I'm sleeping in the front of the car. Slept in the car many times in my life. It's Pechanga. It's
part of the glitter and glamour of professional gambling.
Yes, being a road warrior. So I am asleep. I look like I've been on the road for 6 or 8 days. And
probably smell that way, too.
Correct. And I get the knock, knock, knock on the passenger window. I'm on the passenger front seat. And it's law enforcement. And I kind of rustle. And I open the door and get out. And there's a lot of cop cars there. There's a lot of people there. This isn't just a small health check thing. This is a bad thing. And I'm in handcuffs before I know it. And so he's going through my pockets. And I tell him, you know, I got money in my right front pocket. And you know, it's in excess of $10,000, probably closer to $15,000. And I really don't know everything that's going on, but he's asking my story, and I don't know my friend's last name. I do recall that he had 2 drunk driving tickets and lost his driver's license. So even though he drove us down there without a license, I'm afraid he's going to lie to the cops and say he wasn't driving. But I decide just go with the truth. They haven't even gone to the house to get into these people yet. But it's a drug bust at the house we're at, and I'm in the back of a cop car with a sketchy story at best. And, you know, I don't know the lady who owns the house. I know her first name, and that's it. I really don't know her. And so I go to the cop car, and then they go get these guys. And, like, Teller says, he's, like, 20 years old, and he's white as a sheet. I mean, he is scared.
Yeah, that was a pretty frightening moment for me. All the confidence you have in your friends and thinking that you're doing things that are maybe a little bit not perceived well by people, but it's still not an illegal activity. And then to go outside and see Bank in handcuffs and in the back of a squad car or whatever is not exactly giving me a lot of good feelings. But they were trying to separate all of us to get everybody's story separately. I was, I guess, maybe young enough, didn't really know any better, but I just wouldn't have told the truth, too. So everything started to check out. But in the back of that car, there were also, like, the person we were with, he had a bunch of prescription medication, and then there was a bunch of cash that I had on me. There was a bunch of cash in the back of the car, and they were still kind of thinking that we were part of this other situation. Do you want to close that out?
Basically... The lady we're staying with is a dealer we had played with, we knew. I'd never had much of a relationship with her. She had a grown adult daughter whose boyfriend was dealing drugs, had dealt to an undercover officer, and this was the day they showed up with the entire task force to serve the warrant, and there I was, sleeping in a car out front. And
with lots of money in your pocket.
And in the car, and my friend agreed to let them search the car, and they were finding more and more money. And ultimately... We had enough degrees of separation. The guy they came for, he did go to jail, but the rest of us were basically scared to death. But after a while, they finally come to the conclusion that we were going to be okay and we could have our money back and it was going to be all right. But that was a pretty terrifying event because I was in cuffs in the back of the car. You know, I was about as far as you could go without actually going in for real.
Yeah, it was pretty frightening for all of us. And that was... Although once you kind of shake out of that, you think, well, first you're thinking, let's just get home and get over with this thing. But then we came back to our normal routine and said, well, I guess we're heading back on down the road to Viejas and we'll see how the rest of this thing shakes out.
Yeah, you're lucky they didn't just take the money.
I think today they would.
Yeah.
I think today they would. In those days, I think that they hadn't quite gotten to the part where they were just seizing the money and letting it. Yeah. My sense is that after 9/11, that's got even worse.
Yeah, a lot of collateral damage, right?
Right. And it's always hard when you're 800, 900,000 miles from home and people don't know what exactly it is you do for a living.
Yeah, well, and especially given that you're in front of a drug dealer's house. So.
Well, but you had just won this tournament.
Correct.
Of I don't know what it was, 10,000, 20,000, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah, more, and that's something more than 10, they could verify if they wanted to. So.
And they may have done that because they had our IDs, and we were all separated, and they were, you know, there was a long wait time where we weren't sure what was going to happen. So maybe they did go try to corroborate our story because it was, you know, right down the road. They could have made a phone call, no big deal.
Very good. We want to thank both Bank and Teller. This has been a charming episode. Thank you both for contributing to our show.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.